You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. I hate to announce that my formerly invincible 2005 Toyota Corolla had to be replaced. At 250,000 miles, it simply, the amount of work I have to put into it, simply wasn't worth it. So I had to break down and sign a contract with usurers. I haven't had a car payment in a very long time. I think I got a decent deal. Of course, another Corolla, because it'll be another 250,000 miles. But looking on the contract about how much in interest I'm going to have to pay worried me. And about the same extent, that's the fact that someone actually gave me a loan. I wasn't sure which was more bizarre. So being forced to get a new car was something I really wasn't looking forward to. I knew it was going to happen eventually. I just replaced the brakes on the old Corolla. But unfortunately, I knew that was just a matter of time. So, I don't know. If you have a couple of dollars laying around, I wouldn't mind you sending them to me, because now I have a damn car payment. Involuntary car payment. Now that I've mourned the death of the 05 Corolla, I want to talk about something equally depressing. And it's something that I've dealt with several times, but it just doesn't get boring. And that is the rise in justification of idiocy in political discussion. Now, this isn't a partisan matter. Actually, today there's a whole cottage industry decrying the decay of standards in social life, intellectually speaking. But in those cases, they're usually attacks on Trump. The rise of the alt-right or whatever they're talking about has frightened them, and so they're trying to claim that, you know, anyone who supports that is an ignoramus. And suddenly, liberalism is all about an intellectual aristocracy. It shouldn't surprise you, because they simply have no standards. But that's not what this is. You have no idea how many times a day I utter the phrase, "Please get off my side." This is not a matter of partisanship. All sides have a huge number of idiots. And what I'm talking about more specifically is the notion of politics being a spectator sport. If you were unlucky enough to watch the debate with Trump and what's his name, you'll see how they introduced the proceedings very much like like Monday Night Football. The same kind of music, the same kind of rhetoric, the same kind of imagery. That's really what it is. I've said 100 times that major media has no obligation to educate you. That is not their role. That's not what a journalist does. A journalist is there to find the story, to find the angle. And as mainline media sources lose money, those jobs get scarcer and scarcer, meaning those who have the jobs are doing everything they can to hang on to them, and that means to fully support the agenda in every respect. Liberalism is an official ideology, and it functions by using labels as substitutes for knowledge. But it's not just official liberalism. If you remember, I did a lecture on Hegel's dialectics, making fun of the right's attempt to understand that. And not only do they get it wrong, they get it entirely wrong. It's usually pretty much the opposite of what they think that is. And it's comical, except that they do poison the discussion. And for people who are just getting into this field, hearing someone who sounds like they know making it a ridiculous point is far more dangerous than simple ignorance. Politics is not a spectator sport. It is not an amateur part-time pursuit. Just like any other technical field out there, it's really for a handful of people. And this is the case historically, where, of course, all history is driven by fanatical, determined minorities. But the additional problem, of course, is that professionals in my field are just as bad. They are to, an intellectual aristocracy what billionaire oligarchs are to social aristocracy. They're a perversion, except in their case, the perversion is dressed up in what they think is professional verbiage. This ridiculous virus and the destruction of Western society, which of course were already moribund, is the ultimate case in point. Seems to me, as I'm saying this on October 2nd, that the president has recovered from what I guess is supposed to be this virus, which rarely kills anybody without comorbidities all over the place. I'm pretty sure that almost no one has died of the virus just by itself. I remember back in March, there was a headline in the newspaper, France 24. Guayaquil, a city in the center of Ecuador's coronavirus outbreak, runs out of coffins. And some of you have seen similar, if not identical, headlines concerning other cities and places that you really can't go and check. It's a criminally irresponsible headline that hospitals were bursting, that ERs were overwhelmed, that bodies were piling up in the streets. None of it was true. It was completely invented. But in that headline, the Ecuador running out of coffins, as if there's a national strategic reserve of caskets laying around. Near the end of the article, it says that the number of deaths is 370. That means the entire story was invented. And as it turns out, even that number was exaggerated. But most people don't read. They look at the headline, and they get an emotional response, and that's what they use to interpret everything else. Once the CDC came out and said that comorbidity is absolutely essential, and very few people, of course, the head of the medical examining, or I should say the pathology department, University of Hamburg in Germany, now he's done thousands of medical examinations, and has found not a single example of someone who has died of the virus. There's always some additional factor, something usually very severe. And of course, very old age. Autopsy is what I'm looking for. But you actually have people who will answer to that, well, you don't have an MD, therefore what are you talking about? And it's a cop-out. They certainly have political and historical opinions, certainly on topics that they know nothing about. That doesn't bother them. This is a way for the ignorant to try to shut you up, and you can't let it work. But the truth is, the media, the American public, academics, they're criminally unable to think or act rationally. This is the nature of mass society. The regime can say whatever it wants, and the public, local governments not only believe it, but now actively destroy all dissent. And the primary cause here is the vulgarization and the popularization of politics. It's become a spectator sport rather than a serious discipline. So the citizenry, I mean, even the word citizen doesn't mean much. You know, in the founding generation, a citizen was someone who was free. And in that definition, very few people would actually qualify. They don't have the theoretical understanding, the ability to analyze data, or even to begin to think critically, or know what critical thinking is, or even understand the systematic nature of power. And they shouldn't be. That's not what they do. But the infotainment model of politics claims that this is no different than rooting for the Steelers or, voting online for your favorite band. There's no nice way to talk about this. You know, you're always going to sound like a jerk talking like this, and I don't care. Things like international relations, political philosophy, these are highly theoretical, technical fields. The broad mass of the population shouldn't have any insight to it. Part of the problem is that it uses a technical vocabulary that has no relation, or at least differs from normal conversation. Even the tiniest area, even the tiniest little specialization, now is so overpublished that it would take decades to master the relevant literature and those adjacent to it. And that most of the sources of information the common citizen has no idea even exists, let alone can grasp its contents. And if you go look at a list of informal fallacies, and I've talked about this before too, you'll see that that's a day-to-day in the emotional barking and yelling of mass politics. The concept of an issue, like, you know, gun control or abortion, whatever it is, this is a marketing idea. It's the drive to make everything into entertainment. And because of that, it's destroyed even the most basic understanding of how power works. So for Plato, the forms were for the philosophers, those with tremendous cognitive and critical skill. But of course, everyone else, not capable of that, certainly had every reason to be exposed to the truth. And that took the form of, you know, what they would broadly call poetry and symbols. Symbols in the true sense. Now, today, of course, symbols have been replaced with labels. These are substitutes for knowledge. Political debate is based on cliches and labels that are used as cudgels to beat people up with. Liberalism is taken for granted. The use of labels without any concept of what they refer to is day-to-day. Official liberalism doesn't even need arguments to justify its position. And of course, they operate through caricaturing their opponents. See, one of the reasons I think I'm particularly dangerous is that I went to grad school for many years. That means I know the left's arguments from the inside. I know their best. I know their arguments just as well as they do. On the other hand, They don't know ours at all. The whole notion of a speech code on campus, the whole idea is to keep them in their bubble. And they relate to us simply as caricatures, cartoon characters. But at the time of the drawing up the U.S. Constitution, these men were absolutely uneasy about enfranchising even roughly 4% of the population that was permitted to have any kind of role in politics. The notion of representation was very specific. You had a small group of people in a community. They all knew each other. They were not wealthy, but they were also not poor. They were small landowners, or they were mid-level merchants in the cities who really didn't rely on others for their income and therefore for their opinions. They were literate in the sense that they knew both Greek and Latin, and they were familiar with Greco-Roman history. That was the definition of freedom. That's what a citizen was. But even there, representation was considered too abstract. Even having just, a congressman for several thousand people was considered outrageous by the anti-federalists. Now it's in the hundreds of thousands at least per congressman. Therefore, representation is absolutely impossible. But politics, at its root, it's the systematic study of the state and the society around it. It examines the state, its organs, institutions, not to mention all the social and cultural and psychological factors that mutually influence the operation of the state. And the focus, of course, is on power. Power being the ability of one to force someone else, or at least influence or cajole someone else to do what they want. And that at numerous levels. The individual, the national, the local. And of course, political philosophy, on the other hand, deals with things like rights, justice, freedom, obligation, ethical behaviors. None of this is in the purview of the educated American. And I'm specifically talking about the educated American. And it doesn't produce precise measurements, which means it's not entirely empirical. And of course, there's no chance of there being a single universal paradigm, although liberalism, in the very broad sense, has become that. But that also means that the discipline is highly stagnant. So on the one hand, you have the mass, and I'm using that term specifically, the mass on the one hand was very easy to manipulate, who doesn't know that it doesn't know. On the other hand, you have oligarchic intellectuals who equally don't know that they don't know, except that they know how to dress up their ignorance in official cliches. But issues have nothing to do with how power operates. Questions like the difference between power and authority. What is the concept of progress? What's the nature of community versus a collective? What's the difference between rhetoric and information? Who really controls the state? What is the state? Is the state different from government? Why do factions form? Why do they cooperate? What does development mean? And all the theoretical models that try to explain this. That's the discipline, and that's what political science is, at its best. At its best, using these methods and thinking with a tremendous critical ability can produce actual detailed knowledge. But you can't be subject to an ideological paradigm. It can't be based on self-interest, and it can't be based on pretty much any heteronomous drive. You're not out there to do any special pleading. You're not justifying anything. But the intellectuals in an oligarchy, the absurdities that these people believe, and the very notion that truth can't be known, and therefore it doesn't really matter, you can force people to do what they want, if that's the case. But people who believe that community and the collective are the same, using words like fascism, thinking that just means being against free speech. People who honestly believe that businessmen are conservative, that capitalism somehow is a conservative idea, that nationalism means hatred of others, that crime has no relation to race, that corporate media is independent, that Ivy League schools are more rigorous than others, that imperialism and nationalism are similar, colonization was based on religion, that domestic violence was unpunished until recently, that people used to think the earth was flat, that science and reason didn't exist until modernity, that the founding fathers all owned slaves, Hitler hypnotized Germans into voting for him, that even that propaganda could exist prior to the 19th century, that people died at age 40 in the Middle Ages, that faith is the same thing as credulity, that science is an object, that non-establishment ideas are conspiracy theories, as if people with power don't actually work that way, that Occam's razor means that the simplest explanation is correct, that oligarchy is the same as aristocracy, that the president is the leader of a nation. These are the absurdities that the educated American, including the average American intellectual, actually believes. And if you try to contradict this, you will lose your job, you will be removed, you'll lose all your accounts, and anything you do on social media will be censored. Well, I came across a book that I had read many, many years ago. And I forgot about it. Jacques Ellul's, I believe it was 1965. The book was Propaganda, The Formations of Men's Attitudes. And the concern was exactly what we're talking about. The conception of this level of conformism and ignorance. Now, by propaganda, he's not using this necessarily as a pure negative, but he's using it as non-critical or acritical information. And he bases it very wisely on the concept of a mass society. I've spoken and written about Ortega's idea, the revolt of the masses, many, many times. And ultimately, it's based on isolating individuals or turning people into egos. And they're reduced to this, these semi-human ciphers based entirely on the lowest common denominator. Well, propaganda is something that only came into existence in the late 19th century because society had dissolved. The organic structures of society had totally broken down by capitalism and usury. And so when you remove people from the older organic institutions, especially in rural areas, they become defenseless. They are easy to manipulate. They become emotional. They're more likely to be caught up in fads and fashions. They become conformists. So where you have local institutions being weak, newly arrived rural workers coming into the cities this period of time have no structure. They have no connection to their ancestors. So they can be easily manipulated. They can create a artificial psychological unity. They're creating a collective, not a community. So uniformity, materialism, lowest common denominator, this is what man society is. And the object is to substitute a mass opinion for an actual individual opinion. Now, we all know the notion of an individual is mythical. There is no such thing as this isolated ego. That's a product of, really a product of the Renaissance, and a product of Cartesian thinking that removed context from any role in cognition. The very notion of public opinion, of course, came much later. The idea is to have these egocentric ciphers take public mass opinion as their own and to be convinced that they, in fact, came up with it. You could ask yourself why people adopt the ideologies that they do. Did they make a pro-con list at one point, reading through all the relevant literature on important topics, and after decades of this, finally decided what they're going to be? Well, when you have a tightly controlled mass media, this isn't that hard to pull off. Public opinion is mass opinion. And then once it becomes established and hardened, it's reinforced. And then you could transform opinion into action. Elul uses the concept of the lonely crowd, which is another way of putting mass society. Politicians refer to the people as if it's a thing. The American people, which of course is a non-existent entity. These are the same people, by the way, who don't believe in national cultures, but somehow they believe in the American people or the international community. There's no standards here. It's whatever serves their interest. When you don't believe that there's any such thing as truth, of course, power is all you have left. But then there's no point in having standards in that case. But an individual is not a person. He's only of interest to the propagandist when he is reduced to a mass. He's reduced to an average, and anyone breaking out of that average is condemned. The notion of the lowest common denominator, what everyone has in common. The individual is included, he's integrated into this amorphous mass, because really all you have left is the diffusion of emotions. And then within the mass itself, social sanction and social pressure becomes extremely important. Because of the destruction of organic structures, the reactions that you can provoke are much easier. There are no psychological defenses anymore. You have people refer to the masses without having any idea what they're talking about. The mass is not even a human entity. It's even lower than a crowd. It's a random assemblage of isolated individuals with no store of knowledge, only the most basic education, and fed a diet of tightly controlled but easily accessible ideology. To be in a crowd and to be completely alone is the ultimate end of mass society. This creates suggestibility. To be alone in the mass is absolutely necessary for any kind of propaganda to work. So, Jacques Ellul writes this in the mid-60s. He says, for propaganda to be effective, the propagandee must have a certain store of ideas and a number of conditioned reflexes that can only be acquired through peace of mind springing from relative security. The establishment of a mode of common life. All of this leads to the creation of a type of normal man, conveniently, leads all men towards that norm via a multitude of paths. Propaganda's intent is to integrate people into the normal pattern prevailing in society to bring about conformance to the way of life. It's the creation of normalcy in our society can take one of two shapes. The result of scientific, psychosocial analysis based on statistics, that is the American type. It can be identical, it could be ideological and doctrinaire, the Marxist type. But the results are identical. Such normalcy necessarily gives rise to propaganda that can reduce the individual to the pattern most useful to the society. Now, of course, this has been translated from the French, and I think what he means is that the reduction of the individual, or the destruction of the person made into an individual, is necessary for propaganda to exist at all. But integrating people into the normal or average pattern prevailing in society, this is the nature of conformity. In 1930, It's a few years before Elul wrote. Ortega y Gasset says something extremely important. And I've quoted this before, and it's worth quoting again. Thus, an intellectual life, which is of its essence, requires and presupposes qualification. One can note the progressive triumph of the pseudo-intellectual, unqualified, unqualifiable, and by the very mental texture, disqualified. I may be mistaken, but the present-day writer, when he takes his pen in hand to treat a subject which he has studied deeply, has to bear in mind that the average reader, who's never concerned himself with this subject, if he reads, does so with the view not of learning something from the writer, but rather of pronouncing judgment on him when he's not in agreement with the commonplaces that the said reader carries in his head. Now, I've cited this many times, but in talking about what mass society is, which is necessary for propaganda, and the amateurization of politics. And keep in mind, when I say the, you know, accessibility or amateurization of politics, it doesn't mean anyone has any power. That's just it. There's no way for them to know the difference. Gasset says this: the most radical division that's possible to make of humanity is that which splits it into two classes of creatures. Those who make great demands on themselves, piling up difficulties and duties, and those who demand nothing special of themselves, but for whom to live is to be every moment what they already are, that imposing on themselves any effort towards perfection, mere buoys afloat on the waves. Now, I've said many times that there is this cottage industry that's arisen, condemning this kind of amateurism. But as I've said before, this amateurism is condemned not because of any lack of scientific rigor, but because it tends to lead people into non-establishment areas. There's a book out called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Now, understand the sleight of hand that's in that very title. The death of expertise is one problem. But that has nothing to do with the campaign against established knowledge. The assumption, of course, is that established knowledge is based on expertise. Expertise and established knowledge are certainly not the same thing. So what he's really doing is defending official liberalism, which, without exception, is the ideology of the established expert. It has nothing to do with scientific rigor. But he writes this. He says, the law professor, Elias Soman, pointedly described how little had changed over the last 50 years. Like Hofstadter before him, Soman wrote in 2015 that the size and complexity of government has made it more difficult for voters with limited knowledge to monitor and evaluate the government's many activities. The result is a polity in which the people often cannot exercise their sovereignty responsibly and effectively. More disturbing is that Americans have done little in those intervening decades to remedy the gap between their knowledge and the level of information required to participate in advanced democracy. The low level of political knowledge in American electorate, Soman notes, is still one of the best established findings in the social sciences. It's not just that society has become insanely complex. It's not just that the state has grown to massive proportions, or even that it's now an empire involved in the politics of every country in the world. It's also the fact that the sources of information, the overpublication, the massive literature, and even the most picky of topics, the most obscure of topics, are so overwhelming that even as a full-time job, only a tiny handful of areas can really be mastered. And even that, the explosion of literature that happens all the time, is so great that keeping up with it is as much of a problem as anything else. But you have the problem where someone has mastered a field, not to be a part of some bureaucracy, not to have a career, but master a field for the sake of understanding it, for the sake of justice or something far greater than just personal gain. Over decades of struggle and worry and self-doubt and everything that goes along with that. And of course, that such a person is going to have a certain vocabulary and a way of carrying themselves versus someone who's simply a good actor who memorizes just enough of the official slogans that they sound like one of those people. That's the distinction. When you have a dumbed-down population where debates and discussions are based entirely on one-liners and who's the most entertaining, well, it's very easy for an oligarchy to rule unimpeded. If you were to study taxation, for example, you could spend dozens of lifetimes going through all the relevant documents, the history, the legal aspects of it, the financial aspects of it, the economic aspects of it, private and public sector. It would take years to even begin to master the outlines of what that is. So in terms of something like that, public opinion is absolutely meaningless. People might know a few slogans that they've gotten from God knows where, and yet these opinions are supposed to be taken seriously. The same author says this in the same book. And while they're self-trained experts, these are rare exceptions. More common are the people seeking quick entry into complicated fields but who have no idea how poor their efforts are. They're like the moderately entertaining karaoke singers who think they have a chance to become the next winner of American Idol, or the scratch golfers who think they might take a shot at going pro. Doing something well is not the same thing as becoming a trusted source of advice or learning on a subject. The problem is there are few self-trained experts because there's really no way to tell good information from bad. Comparing facts and ideas implies the knowledge of method. Method has to come first. It also demands a certain command over logic. Most of you have heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect. For those who haven't, it really isn't anything new. All of us overestimate ourselves. But the less competent you are in any particular field, the more you overestimate yourself. There's a battery of work out there, which I think is very interesting, that seems to confirm that people who don't know much about something, especially if they're cognitive, technical, or a social skill, the more ignorant they are, the more grossly they overestimate their prowess and performance. It could be anything from grammar to logic to medical life, finances, economics. The danger is pretty clear. Now, this isn't to justify, say, in the realm of health. It isn't to justify the medical establishment. But it's equally dangerous for people who read a couple of books to start making medical decisions or giving advice to others. That's just as bad as a medical establishment sealed off from reality. I was a university professor for many years. I continue to teach now and again. And even in my 20s, I realized a simple fact. That college students, that there's such an overwhelming explosion of universities after the 50s. A massive explosion of college students that, not to mention competition for these students among these schools, that you have a huge amount of people who have no right to be in college. And people have this silly prejudice that in order to be successful, which of course is defined in financial terms, you have to go to college. This is nonsensical. I was raised to believe things like that. But it's simply not true. There are too many students. There are too many colleges. And not, and only very few of these people have any real academic interest. And making matters worse, the concept of what's an academic subject has been completely redefined. That, you know, post-war boomer kind of understanding of education is that to be successful is to at least have gone to college. But this is significant because the death of expertise is based to some extent on it. You have this massive proliferation of programs which are usually non-academic. The rise of the diploma mill was inevitable. Education has become training, which are two completely different things, but they are conflated. And even worse than that, now it's neither education nor training. It's a simple matter of attendance. He says, on the internet, as in life, money and popularity unfortunately count for a lot. Plugging words into a browser window isn't research. It's asking questions of programmable machines that themselves cannot actually understand human beings. Actual research is hard. And for people raised in an environment of constant electronic stimulation, it's also boring. Research requires the ability to find authentic information, summarize it, analyze it, write it up, and present it to others. Not just a province of scientists and scholars, but a basic set of skills a high school education should teach every graduate because of its importance in any number of jobs and careers. But why bother with all that tedious hoop jumping when the screen in front of us already has the answers, generated by the millions in just seconds, and beautifully laid out, colorful, authoritative-looking websites? I spoke it on this show, actually very recently, on the idea of freedom. Very few people know how to define it, or even care to know how to define it. But recently I've been reading quite a bit on revolutionary cynicalism, and I've always been sympathetic to it. But even the most philosophical of them still take for granted the idea of, they use slogans like societies of free men, or self-governing guilds. But it did occur to me that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that all people are capable of freedom. Freedom requires a profound use of reason independently of self-interest or any other internal drive like that. When you talk about ideologies like this and these abstractions like freedom, at a minimum, freedom means that all your actions are your fault, regardless of the distinction between intent and consequences. Existentialism is really based on the idea that most people run away from freedom. They want the illusion of it. But since freedom means responsibility, it's not very attractive, so they redefine it as purely negative, meaning it's just the ability to pursue whatever passion you happen to be possessed of at the moment without any external interference. Marshall Tito's experiment in Yugoslavia did have a relatively healthy root. The self-management idea in Yugoslavia brought down hellfire from the Soviet Union to the point where they even were threatening Belgrade with invasion. The experiment, of course, was a failure. Self-management meant that workers themselves were placed in charge of the factories. You think it seems like a commonplace idea that any socialist should be concerned with. And I've always been very sympathetic to it, except that it failed. And the problem was that few workers really could be bothered with the minutiae of administration. It entailed long hours after work, dealing with all kinds of boring administrative tasks. So, almost right away, a class of professional politicians emerged and took over the process. But Tito introduced a rotational law to fight all this. But passing a law like this had no relation to the cause of the issue in the first place. Freedom is of immense difficulty, and only few have or even want it. Freedom, like reason, and of course they're one and the same, is constant labor. It's constant thought. It's constant warfare with your passions. Struggle for autonomy. The opposite of negative freedom. But freedom and reason are two sides of the same coin. To be free and irrational doesn't make any sense. The whole notion of freedom is the ability to think through a problem and act on it. Freedom has to be rational and totally autonomous. But how many people are capable of that? I'm not talking about logic. I'm not talking about rationalization. But existentialism has always concerned itself with the notion that true freedom is usually an intolerable burden. When I mentioned the Yugoslavia example, because it showed that few workers actually wanted to rule themselves. They wanted to put in their 8 hours and leave, rather than putting in 8 hours and then spending 4 more hours going over production targets or relations with suppliers, all the minutiae that went into this. My favorite work in philosophy, I would say, or actually or maybe my ultimate favorite, but one of the first I ever came across, and I've mentioned it before, is Plato's Gorgias. It is one of the best introductions to the philosophical method that I've ever come across, and it's fairly accessible. I always laughed at these academics. You know, they're institutionalized, self-seeking, intellectually inbred, and conformist pseudo-scholars really can't deal with someone like Plato. By the very structure of their lives, they can't understand him. Plato was talking about them. It wasn't just the ignorant mass that's the problem. It's their mirror image, the ignorant elite. The Gorgias is one of these amazing introductions. People want freedom in the same sense that they want honesty. Only a handful of people actually mean it, and even fewer are capable of living it consistently. Humanity, by and large, cares only about having their lifestyle validated. What they want to hear is what concerns their current interest and justifying their worldview. But the question isn't necessarily about public debate here. These terms are so debased that they have no meaning anymore. Plato's Gorgias is not really about the political speech of citizens in a democracy. That doesn't even come up. These words like speech, like citizen, like democracy, like political, all of these certainly didn't mean the same 2,500 years ago as they do today. In fact, quite the opposite. For an American, if you're a citizen, if you turn the magic age of 18 and continue to breathe, none of these have any functional meaning. But the distinction is between the idea of reason and oratory, or as I said before, the difference between rhetoric and reason. When Plato uses words like oratory or rhetoric, it implies a world that no truths are accepted or understood. The only thing that matters is power. That's Socrates' whole argument. If the world existed where truth mattered, rhetoric would have no place, or at the very least would be a very secondary one. Rhetoric would be used for non-specialists. Truth would be used, understood by philosophers. The rest understand through symbols. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But another way of understanding symbol is a controlled use of rhetoric. But when rhetoric takes on a life of its own, it's a sign of social decay. It's a sign that society has deviated so far from truth that those most pleasing to the ear are as good as diligent research. And there's no distinction between them, and there's no way to judge. The concept here is that rhetoric, that sign of decay, rhetoric is the same as propaganda in this case, it's an evil unless it's founded on truth. The only alternative is self-interest. The question isn't about producing convictions or beliefs. It's about producing conviction among the powerful, with no foundation in any truth. It's the will to power. power is not free by definition, but authority is. And Socrates in this dialogue, and I've mentioned this many times, and it's worth repeating. Gorgias being Gorgias is a sophist or a rhetor, very pompous and full of himself because he's mastered the art of making his argument seem good when whether it is or not. And he destroys his pomposity by connecting knowledge to orator. There is no particular craft of speaking well, that is, of manipulating others. Now, I said this about journalists. It's always struck me that journalists are not expert in the field that they're writing in. That's always been strange to me. But those who have legitimate expertise within a craft are the only ones who have a right to talk about that craft. That's knowledge, not manipulation. But if you don't know, what choices do you have? If you don't know, you could admit you don't know. There's not, no one dies when you say that. Or you could fake it. The worst possible option is that you don't know you don't know. But the literature on Plato talks about speeches as if he's talking about someone on a stump speech. That's what these university professors are talking about, and yet actually Socrates is talking about them. Plato means any form of communication about the world relevant to power. It doesn't refer to the ordinary speech of people. Speech connected to knowledge is called a lecture, of course. Expertise communicates itself. But rhetoric, journalism, advertising, PR, that's not part of any body of knowledge. So by process of elimination, the only thing you can do is manipulate. So he's really talking about not speech making, but public relations, media control. It refers to all forms of communication that the oligarchs can afford, which includes, of course, modern academics. Illegitimacy requires PR. But PR people don't work for free. So 2,500 years ago, you had a Platonic dialogue about control over political language and therefore the control of the very nature of reality. So Gorgias says at 452e, he says, I'm referring to the ability to persuade by speeches judges in a law court, counselors in a council meeting, assemblymen in an assembly, or any other political gathering that might take place. In point of fact, with this ability, you'll have a doctor for your slave, and the physical trainer too. As for this financial expert of yours, he'll turn out to be making more money for someone else instead of himself. For you, in fact, if you've got the ability to speak and to persuade the crowds. It's a direct attack on the soapboxer. Speaking of silly abstractions like an American democracy or procedural justice. No one ever fights for this. Anyone uses universalist abstractions like that, it's a sheer sign, a pure sign of ignorance. It's a veil behind which their agenda really lies. But getting to that agenda can be dangerous. When someone has no right to rule, you hire Gorgias. You hire a PR firm. And in this dialogue, he's defending a world of corruption. He's persuading people pretending to be knowledgeable in the field by presenting information with just enough professional verbiage to make it seem irrefutable. He's not imparting information, he's concealing it. Now, of course, he claims that he'll only use his skill in the defense of justice. But Socrates says that this is question begging. He would have to know the nature of justice in the first place, which is, by the way, another skill entirely. Rhetoric, PR, the very lifeblood of liberal democracy. It's not a craft in itself. It's not a field because it's not based on any knowledge. And journalism should be included here. It's not based, it produces nothing. It's not based on anything. And it can only act as a parasite on those crafts that actually do produce things. But Socrates says this. Rhetoric takes no thought of whatever is best with the lore of what's most pleasant at the moment. It sniffs out folly and hoodwinks it so that it gives the impression of being most deserving. Pastry baking has put on the mask of medicine and pretends to know the foods that are best for the body, that if a pastry baker and a doctor had to compete in front of children, or in front of men just foolish as children, to determine which of the two, the doctor or the pastry baker, has expert knowledge of good food and bad, the doctor would die of starvation. Now, pastry baking, of course, he means junk food. So, a journalist PR firm with enough money can be hired by this man to convince the world that what he does is nutritious. That's day-to-day advertising. This is taken for granted today. Unregulated, millions would believe it. But, you know, unhealthy food, because it tastes good, will win out over artichoke hearts every day. It would lead to severe health problem. And people wouldn't know why. So Socrates' argument is that oratory or rhetoric or PR or journalism, it's promoting candy to children. It looks and tastes good. And if one doesn't think about it for too long, it'll be consumed constantly and become a lifestyle. But even if these unhealthy or obese people complain later on, the same oration would convince them that it's their fault for being so gullible. What's the point here? You consider a doctor speaking to a crowd. He uses dry statistics. He uses boring charts. He talks about carbohydrates and all the technical verbiage of the human body, the damage it can do over time. He then advocates beets or asparagus as a proper healthy diet, cranberries. But then he's followed by a guy pushing M&Ms. He'll then mock the dry rhetoric of the doctor. He'll remind the crowd how terrible beets are. Then using humor and parody, he'll discredit the dry analysis of the doctor, what he was trying to get across. Notice having nothing to do with information. He's not saying he's incorrect. He's just distracting. So who would win here? Well, sugar's going to win over asparagus every single time. It shouldn't be difficult to know what he's talking about here. Take this into politics or science, it means that the simplest quick fix would get the support of the population if it had strong enough public relations. Modern democracy preys on ignorance. No one wants to hear lengthy lectures on budgetary issues, so symbolic issues and distractions are going to be used. It's the analog to pastries and candy. And the PR firm, the orator, has no interest in the truth of the matter, and is really a sociopath. He's free to say and do whatever is needed to gain the confidence of the crowd. This is the concept here. So you have a political culture that has nothing to do with politics, has to do with entertainment, mediated by a media, that's what the word media means, controlled by a handful of people who can prey on the ignorance of the population and even point to professionals in the academy or in the scientific establishment that agree with them. None of this, however, has to do with truth. If you're a professor in an American university, why are you going to think too hard? You don't have to. You're not getting any fundamental opposition. Your opposition can be easily turned into a caricature. All the media is doing is regurgitating your ideas right back to you as news. And it becomes this terribly inbred, unjust system. So long as the money holds out. Those revolting against that are going to have a problem, because unfortunately, to be able to put the agenda for revolt together properly, it takes a tremendous amount of detailed knowledge. A revolutionary group taking over is often in a lot of trouble, because rhetoric on the street and on the barricades is one thing. Having to govern the budgetary process of local government is quite another. Using propaganda, using distractions, using violence and purges, this is a way that they try to fix this problem. my dissertation on Michael Oakeshott had to do with exactly this problem. Anyway, the point here is modern American and Western political debate is absurd. Knowledge and truth are not concerns, and it doesn't matter what side you're on. It is not a spectator sport. It is not a part-time job, and the press has no obligation to tell you the truth. Unfortunately, on the side of nationalism, you have a handful of people with that level of insight, and even there, don't have the money, don't have the backing to continue their work, unlike those, you know, establishment liberals who have billions of dollars at their disposal at any given moment. The universities, media, it's all one and the same. They're promoters of official liberalism. They'll even create a fake opposition, which is just a slightly more moderate version of official liberalism. That's the nature of our situation today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.